This episode is brought to you by OmniFocus.guru, a seminar hosted by yours truly, free for the Rad Awakenings community. It's that time of the year where we come out guns a-blazing with resolutions, habits, and intentions. Yet most of them fall flat, especially in the category of things that are important but not urgent. This could include side projects, learning goals, or health and fitness. The challenge is that a lack of a hard deadline makes following through almost impossible. One tool that's helped me over the past decade is a piece of software called OmniFocus. OmniFocus lets you implement David Allen's Getting Things Done philosophy, or GTD. I get asked all the time how I use it, so I'm going to host a free webinar to share my approach. It's totally free. Sign up at OmniFocus.guru. That's OmniFocus.guru. See you there. Welcome to the Rad Awakenings podcast. I'm Kay He. When was the last time you became aware of something deep, provocative, and uncomfortable? In these moments, we level up in our work, our creativity, and most importantly, in our own heads. Each episode, our guests will describe their Rad Awakenings. The conversations are real, raw, and will share in both struggle and joy. Thomas Page McBee is an author and journalist who writes about masculinity and gender. I gotta admit, I entered this conversation pretty nervous. Because Thomas is trans, I felt uncomfortable about being insensitive and uninformed, but I also approached the conversation with some preconceived beliefs. These beliefs were based on the popular media narratives about the trans community. Thomas and I discuss where his story diverges, and he helps me understand that gender is complicated for all of us. Thomas has a unique perspective on issues that many men struggle with, including emotional detachment, gender policing, shame, and violence. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. Today's guest is Thomas Page McBee, a colleague of mine. How's it going?
Great.
So, Thomas, tell us a little bit about where you're from and your childhood.
So, I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or just outside of it. And I guess I grew up, what is there to say about my childhood? I mean, I wrote a whole book about it. But I guess, I grew up in a family with two siblings who I'm really close to, and basically was raised by my mom. And though I did have a father who was part of my life for a while, but mostly was raised by my mom. So, grew up in a... My mom was an extremely powerful woman. She was an executive at General Electric early on in her career, in the 80s, before women were in those sorts of roles. She worked for Ted Kennedy out of college. She was a physicist, and she was from a small town and a working class family. So she sort of had really elevated herself in this way that I think really impacted me growing up with a mom like that, of seeing a woman be successful in that way. So that was sort of a defining thing amongst many defining things about my childhood.
And your siblings, where do you rank?
Oh, I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
Proudly the oldest, yeah. The oldest are the best, as we all know.
Yeah.
Are you an oldest?
I am the oldest.
Yeah, so yes. You know. Yeah. I mean, we don't often tell the others, but yeah. But I have a younger sister and younger brother.
Got it. And you were born Paige.
Yeah.
And you talk about I'll throw in my disclaimer right here. We were talking about this earlier. I confessed to Thomas that I felt really nervous about the conversation that we were about to have. I don't have any trans friends.
Except for me.
Except for you, yes. You're my only trans friend. I am always afraid of putting my foot in my mouth by saying the wrong term and pronouns, mm-hmm. and things like that. But yeah, so Thomas gave me permission to he said he'd hold me accountable, but
right.
There was leeway for screw-ups of mine.
Yep.
So maybe putting myself out there first was growing up as a girl, when did your sense of gender identity start to take shape?
So let me make my first corrective. I actually never felt like a girl, ever. I mean, when I was really young, I've seen pictures of myself. As a baby, my mom put me in sort of frilly things. But then she was, because of the kind of woman she was sort of unbound by gender roles in the way of working women of that era. And so she really didn't care when I, as a kid, I just had, really strong preferences for boys' clothing and boys' things to do, which of course are not hardwired in any way, but I was just more attracted to boy activities and whatnot. And in my whole life, that really wasn't ever a problem for me. So I didn't, you know, I grew up sort of as a very masculine young person, and I knew I was queer. I always dated women and girls when I was younger. And so I went up until I was 30, I sort of just lived a life of like a masculine looking queer person and just knew I had a different kind of gender, but wasn't specifically, I didn't feel any kind of push to transition explicitly. But I also had a lot of ideas about men that were troubling because I'd grown up in an abusive environment with my father and had a lot of negative run-ins with men. So I think that was part of maybe my algebra internally about my gender. But I guess growing up, I felt pretty encouraged to just be myself. And that didn't, I think for like a lot of kids, actually, if there weren't a lot of gender roles, we would probably all just invent our own on some sort of spectrum. And that for me is just what I did. And it wasn't really, I didn't have a lot of friction about that until I was much older, which I should say also, because you know all this because I'm a writer, and I would never just talk to you about being trans outside of that context. So, you know, I wrote a book about it and I write about these issues and about masculinity and about just our, I think the way that we are gender fundamentalists in this culture and need to like think more differently and deeply about this, all of us, trans or not. So just to flag that.
And you will definitely come back to gender fundamentalists. I would love to expound on that. And so how did your peer, you know, especially in around teenage years, mm-hmm. how did your peers think of you and perceive you? If you describe it in a very assured mm-hmm. way.
Yeah.
How did that translate socially?
Yeah, so this was like the 90s.
Because we're around the same. How old are you?
I'm 36.
Yeah, so I'm 38. I know that when I was in high school, no one was, I went to high school in downtown New York City, and no one was openly gay in 1993 to 1997.
Yeah.
So, you know, shift that only by a couple of years for trans in Pittsburgh.
It wasn't comfortable, but you know, that's why I think I was such an early adopter of internet things, because I found the community really easily through the internet, because this was the days of like AOL, IMing, you know, and MySpace and that sort of thing. So I think I found queer community online. And then also, weirdly, I grew up, you know, outside of Pittsburgh, but there was a high school that was a private high school that had like just a very progressive aesthetic, I guess. And I met like one person from that school and ended up then sort of infiltrating and becoming almost like an honorary student there. So I ended up dating people from there. And there was just all of these out queer kids at this high school. So I think I had this like, in my own high school, it was a not great experience, but I had this sort of alternative life, like with all of these other high schoolers. And then I also had this incredible, I think being an artist really young, my mom really encouraged my writing, and I got a lot of encouragement in my writing from teachers and whatnot. And I actually went to a summer program, like a free arts program. It doesn't exist anymore, but it's called Governor School for the Arts. And it was like a state subsidized program for 5 weeks, people from all over in Pennsylvania, and they did them in other states too, and it's free. And I had this kind of amazing experience of being with 200 kids who were 17, who were like just the weirdos from their small towns, like, you know, and queer kids and like all kinds of kids. And so I think I had this like much, and my mom always encouraged us to sort of like, you know, I went to New York a bunch growing up, and I understood the world was a lot bigger than my town or my high school. So I wasn't sort of, I don't know. I mean, in a way, it must be harder to be in high school in New York and feel trapped because like you're in New York and you think like, oh wow, this is
if
it,
I'm
right?
Trapped here,
yeah,
like,
right.
Yeah.
But I think in a way it was an advantage to be from a small place because it felt like the world was so much bigger than that town and I could just see it even in my own looking around, you know? So I guess I did feel assured because I knew I would have an artistic life and a life in a city and a life outside of where I was from.
You said with the kids in your high school specific, it was more difficult.
Yeah, they weren't so great.
What what were some of the difficulties?
I had a couple friends in high school. I wasn't like immensely popular. I was like the weird kid who dressed like masculinely and was queer. The kids kind of left me alone, but they actually really bullied my sister and brother. So that was
because of
me, yeah. So that was really awful for them because they didn't have sort of a a secondary like life in the way I did. So I think that that was a challenge that I knew happened and felt bad about. And also it was like just a lot of minor stuff. I wasn't like beat up or anything. I just was like in a constant state of, you know, being hassled by like a minority, I guess, of the kids. It wasn't like the whole school was against me. I was getting thrown into lockers, but I had negative experiences regularly enough. And then just being in the world, I had a lot of negative experiences, like, until I transitioned, because, I, you know, and it was not every day, but I was threatened pretty regularly, or, like, you know, I had strangers give me a hard time in bathrooms, you know, I mean, that sort of thing. Like, that was, the bathroom thing was hard to, eventually I figured out, like, a systematic way to do it, but it was, like, the men's room was dangerous for one reason, the women's room was dangerous for another. So, you know, would I rather be uncomfortable in the women's room or safe? So, like, that was, that sort of stuff was, like, the things I was thinking about and dealing with.
Was the bathroom issue an issue before you transitioned? Because, why was it an issue before?
Oh, because I looked like a boy.
Were you trying to make yourself like,
yeah, I was like a masculine kid and grew up, and I never wore girls' clothes. Yeah. Like, so I had short hair. Yeah. And, you know, when you're younger, and this is why I think it took me a while to transition, when you're younger, really until you're about 25, 26, 27, until men your own age, like, start to look different. I mean, I just looked like a boy, and it was pretty, like, I wasn't necessarily telling people. I wasn't saying, like, I'm a boy, you know, use male pronouns, but I was able to move in the world in a masculine way, and other men my age and boys my age looked like me, because they didn't have, like, man body. So, like, so yeah, I just, like, looked like any other teenage or young adult boy, and then, you know, I kind of liked being different, which I was. There was a point where that stopped being true, you know, like, men just get bigger, they like fill out and they just start to look different, and that is when I transitioned, because I realized, oh, you know, all along I felt very masculine and this has sort of worked for me, but now there's been this turning point where I can't come off. I either look like I'm 16, which is weird. You know, I wasn't able to live in my body in the way that made sense anymore.
And that is around filling out physically, facial hair.
Yeah, it was sort of like late 20s, like when guys just started to look really different. Yeah.
I would have thought that would be more like 16 to like early 20s.
No, because, like, you know, a lot of guys are still skinnier then, and not, I mean, this was sort of before the beard craze, so a lot of guys didn't have facial hair, and I looked like college, like, maybe, like, younger than a lot of the guys around me, but I definitely, like, looked in the same sort of schematic, and I think I didn't totally know I was trans exactly. Yeah. I mean, in retrospect, I was, but, I mean, it's, like, there's also, especially then, it was sort of like there was a sort of vogue of being trans that I sort of grew up like in my 20s around, because I was in San Francisco and I thought, oh, I'm not relating to the stories of the people around me, and especially I'm not relating to the media stories about what being trans means, so I must not be trans. And then there was a point where I just felt like, yeah, I definitely am, and I need to change all these things.
This was like a decade before Caitlyn Jenner.
Uh-huh.
What was the trans media story in like the late 90s?
No, this is not the late 90s. This was like the mid to late aughts. So when I first transitioned, it was 2010. And the kind of first thing I did was start writing a lot for, you know, I'd been a writer and I'd written for media outlets before, but I just immediately was like, I need to write about being trans, because the way I'm seeing this presented actually, like, probably delayed my ability to transition, because I just didn't relate to any of these stories. At the time, it was very much like there was two kinds of stories. There was the born in the wrong body story, which was just sort of like this very reductionist, like, palatable, like, sort of, these people seem like aliens, but, like, okay, picture this, you're born in the wrong body. Like, it's like that. And the sort of idea behind it, I think, was to, like, help make trans people relatable, which is ironic because trans people have existed literally since the dawn of time. So it's, like, kind of weird that it's, like, you know, it's almost like, oh, we've got to, like, explain this because it's so crazy. But it's not really. It's a historical, cultural. Being trans, whatever you want to call it, has been part of pretty much every culture for always. But anyway, so there was that narrative. And then the other big narrative that was happening right around when I started transitioning was the trans kids, which I think was a big deal because people were, again, looking to try to sort of explain being trans, and that was like a sympathetic, you know, it's sort of like aimed at the parents. So like, imagine your kid, like, you know, first of all, they can't help it because they're a child. And second of all, you know, you're like a normal person. And so how would you react if your child came to you and they said they wanted to kill themselves and they were five? And which all of that is fair, but it's sort of like, I wasn't either of those things. I didn't think I was born in the wrong body, and I wasn't a child trying to kill myself. So I think it seemed important to like sort of have trans people report stories and tell stories about what being trans was, and like kind of expand the narrative. And we had all these other places we were talking, you know, like on Tumblr and like in, you know, these sort of internet spaces, but in media there's sort of fixation on trans people but not actually a real sense of what it even meant. And it was sort of going through this strange filter. I don't think it was really doing anyone any favors in explaining the whole phenomenon of being trans.
I remember listening to a trans person give a talk, and the figure that jumped out at me was this, like 50% of the trans community has attempted suicide once. And that it's a little bit like the second narrative that you've described. And I could only see the trans community through that one lens. And it's a jarring statistic. I mean, presumably you know a lot about that statistic and how it impacts the community. But as an outsider, if that's your only lens to see an entire group of people, like, you're just starting in a different place, you know? And I'm actually surprised in the sense, in talking to you, it's like, I'm thinking of things in like very binary, like when did you think you were a boy and like a girl? And you are just, you have this kind of like flow. I'm like trying to put constructs around your story, and your story is constructless, and you have this like chill to it. I guess that I'm seeing this interplay of like trying to explain everything in like very discrete units.
Right. I think that discreteness, though, is part of, I mean, so the suicide thing is real, and maybe that's why I led with the thing about my mom, because I grew up in a family where my gender really wasn't a problem, and never was, like, really. And so that kind of support, even with a culture where that was problematic, just really changed things for me. And I then had a queer community, so I had a whole, like, world of people, like, my entire life who were, like, cool with me. And I think if I'd come from a different environment or a different family, then yeah, it would have been super scary to like, and if I'd seen gender as something that had to be a binary, probably a lot earlier, I would have been like, I'm trans. That's what I am. That's the label. I need to be a boy. I mean, and not to say again that this is anyone else's experience. I'm just saying for me, maybe the reason why that seems true is because, you know, I personally think binaries are problematic in pretty much any place they exist, you know, because it's almost always a power structure, you know. In my research, I'm writing a book about masculinity, and one thing that really struck me about sort of a defining trait that this researcher who'd been studying Danish men had found was that, you know, in America, men define being a man as not being a woman. And in her research, the way Danish men define being a man is not being a boy. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to think about the implications of that, you know, and how sexism, like, operates. And so anyway, that was a rabbit hole. But I guess my point is, like, I think I didn't have a lot of structure around gender growing up. I mean, I obviously live in this world. You know, I saw in my own family, gender roles were not, at work anyway, were not the way they were necessarily portrayed in media. And then I was in a queer community and world where I didn't see gender and relationships portrayed the way I was seeing them in the dominant culture. So I think I just was lucky enough to find and have other models. So then when I saw the way transition narratives worked, I think that's certainly true for some people, but I wonder how many people it would be true for I think the whole point of the suicide statistic is like, yeah, because we punish people for doing this or for feeling like their genders don't match their bodies, like they feel like they can't exist in this world. And that's what's sort of startling to me. It's not like being trans makes you suicidal. It's the world.
Yeah, that welcomes you or unwelcomes you.
Yeah, it sucks that you have to be lucky. Yeah. Like, it sucks that maybe the reason I have just a sort of humane story of my own life is just because I lucked out. Like, you know, that's like, that's not fair. That should be just everyone's ability to have a story of themselves, you know?
And from a sexuality perspective, you always were attracted to women?
Yeah, though plenty of trans men are attracted to men, and then they're just gay. But yeah, no, I was always attracted to women. But that makes me straight now, which is interesting. that's been a big change.
Yeah.
Though I'm still queer identified, but then that's confusing for people.
Yeah, myself.
Well, I mean, in the sense that I since I was 14, I've had queer friends and community, and yeah. That's sort of the world I grew up in. I lived in San Francisco. I mean, most of my close friends are queer in one way or the other. So to me, like, that's my sexuality got fostered in that world. Yeah. And in fact, the people my partner is a woman who's queer. So sort of like the people I've been drawn to, even after my transition, are queer identified.
And are the trans and the queer communities normally so adjacent to one another?
Yeah. I mean, trans women were actually at the forefront of Stonewall, which is part of history that's been erased entirely. Trans women of color specifically have been like the leaders in pretty much every queer initiative that's happened. And then the sort of like the gay marriage sweep, like for a lot of people, became like this sort of turning point where, you know, a really certain kind of gay person and queer person became like elevated as like an idea of what being gay meant or queer meant, and kind of erased all the other, you know, the freaks and queers and trans people, yeah, who'd been part of like this whole thing in the first place. I mean, the Stonewall, like, people forget that was like a grungy bar full of like butch lesbians and, you know, johns and sex workers and trans women, and it wasn't like, you know, the like middle class gay men, you know, like so the trans and queer communities, the trans and queer communities have always been aligned, and within some realm of, I mean, there's always been conflict to some degree or another within any community, but those communities remain aligned. I think it's the trans and gay and the queer and gay communities that are not always aligned politically.
So am I hearing right that there is some element of the queer community that feels left behind in this kind of same-sex world that we live in now?
Or just disagreed with that as like a first step place to be putting a lot of energy. Because it was sort of like, you know, in the Maslow pyramid of needs or whatever, yeah, like there's trans women who are literally getting murdered all, yeah, the time. And so that's not a priority, but gay marriages, which all of these things are priorities.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
everyone should have all of these things. But I think there was a sense of like, but what about all of these people who are not getting their basic needs met?
Still trying to survive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not forgotten. I'm fine.
Yeah.
I work at courts.
Like, yeah,
you know, I'm totally okay, but I'm a very privileged trans person. A lot of people aren't so privileged.
Yeah. And when did you actually start to think about transitioning?
I don't know. I mean, I always had a pretty, like, you know, like I said, like a pretty, like, fluid understanding of my gender. I even had, like, there was sort of, this now is kind of more of a thing, but I had top surgery years before I actually went on hormones and was sort of like, meh, like, I don't know. I it was sort of like a step-by-step thing. Like, I knew I wanted to do that.
Can you explain that? Because I had to look it up when I first...
Well, I just had, like, chest reconstruction surgery, so my chest was male appearing. And so I did that before I went on hormones or anything, and I didn't change my name or my gender identity. I just was sort of, like, trying to do things in a way that felt right to me, one step at a time. And it wasn't like the point was to get to this thing, you know. But then actually, you know, so I wrote this book called Man Alive.
Yeah.
That's a memoir, and the idea of the memoir was that I wanted to write, this was sort of, you know, a few years ago when I was trying to write against like the trans narrative, and I felt very clear on what that was, which was, sorry, the third trans narrative, which we didn't get to discuss, is the triumphant one, where it's like, look at this person who like went through this thing and then they came out the other side and now they're finally themselves, and isn't that inspiring? And like
a hero's journey of sorts.
It's a hero's journey. And you know, everyone has a hero's journey, so that's true. But I guess I think any kind of othering is violent. And I really wanted to write a story about like being, transitioning from being a young adult to being an adult. And that was what the book was about. And so it's sort of about these, I think, the universal things that come up, like as you are, like, I don't know, like becoming your full adult self. And for me, like one thing among many things was that I realized I was trans and I had to transition. But in the book, it's like really the last quarter of the book is about that. And I felt very aware that there were a lot of books about just the, like, to me, the very othering details of like, you know, surgeries and hormones and what is this like? And I understand people being curious about that. But I also think the curiosity is an emotionally distancing thing. Like, it's a lot easier to think you're interested in something or to sort of dehumanize people with your interest almost. And so I wanted to write a story where I obviously knew people might pick it up because I was trans, but I wanted them to then read a story where they just, people who weren't trans, saw themselves in the story very clearly, you know, and could relate to that, to just, because to me being trans was just such a, it's like one of many things that makes me similar to other people in a universal way. Yeah. Like, there's not to me something radically different about my experience than anyone else's.
And I was struck by one line where you said, I try to honor that I'm a complicated human.
Uh-huh.
And when you talk about the life narrative or the transition narrative, it's like, yeah, for me personally, so much of my own angst and what I work through is kind of admitting and acknowledging to myself my imperfections and my complications. And when you distill it down to these like core human elements, you know, and again, this is where I'll admit I approach this conversation and I never really thought about the phrase otherness, but I approached it through the lens of otherness where I feel bad about it because in a sense it's like, oh, like, this is someone who's really different and like, let's put him under a lens and like, look at like these different surgeries and things that, and how alone he must feel in the world and things like that. And like, that's what I brought to the conversation, like subconsciously,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then I'm sitting here talking to you and I'm like, God, why did I mentally have to even start
right.
from that place?
Yeah, but it is, I think that's where this sort of narrative thing is really important, right?
Yeah.
Because there aren't a lot of stories like mine.
Yeah.
It's not as dramatic or interesting when someone's like, actually, you know what being trans is like? It's a lot like being pregnant and like having a lot of hormonal changes and then, you know, and sort of knowing you need to do something, but not really, yeah. You know, and this is from conversations I've had with women who've had babies, so which I had a lot of friends have babies as I was transitioning. So this is why it's my example. It's my go-to example, but it's true. Like when my friends who were women got pregnant, they didn't know what being a mom was going to be like for them. They didn't even know if it was right for them, but they had a strong feeling that it would be good. And they were really hoping it would all work out. And then they go through this period in the beginning where they're like hormonal and it feels crazy and weird. And then they first have the baby and they're like, it's complicated because they love the baby, but they also don't know how to be a mom yet or like what it means to be a mom in the world. And I'm picking moms because of the body part, not because they're specifically the primary parent necessarily, but I'm just saying this whole the identity crisis that happens and it's permanent. Like, it's not like you're going to go back and not be a mom. So that whole arc, like for me, it feels to me a lot like the trans arc. Like, it's not like some massively different life experience than anything that you can envision. You know, it's just one of a myriad of like ways of being a person.
Yeah.
And it has a lot more in common, I think, with things that people are familiar with than not in common,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no. And listening to you describe that, I mean, my wife having just given birth to our second, like everything you just described, I'm living that every day. It's the source of our highs. It's the source of our lows. It's a place where I often lack empathy. I'm like, I don't get this. Like, what was different yesterday than today, you know?
Yeah. And if you take the hormones in the body out of it, I'm sure any identity change, like becoming a dad, I assume, yeah. also is like a massive shift in
yeah.
like, you know, how you see yourself and like, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a dad yet, but I know a lot of the things I'm thinking about when I'm thinking about becoming a parent mm-hmm. are things I thought about when I thought about transitioning. Like,
yeah.
is this the right thing to do? How do I know? Like, how will I know if it's right? Like, I guess I won't know until I do it.
Yeah.
I hope, you know, there's a lot at stake though, so I hope it's right. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you literally don't know with most big life things, like until you're actually in it, if it's who you are. And
yeah.
then even then you sort of become that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't think it's such a mystery really. It's
yeah.
like, I guess the one thing about being trans that is probably different than those examples is the like, I experienced, and I think a lot of people talk about this, just a genuine urgency, a genuine discomfort or alarming level of like, you know, but I think people can relate to that too. Like if you've ever been in a marriage or a job or anything, I mean, lower stakes, but where you're just like, this is not right, not right, not right, not right. It feels really bad and you need to change it and you know it. And it's like a visceral experience of like, this has got to change. And for me, that's when I transitioned, was like when I felt that way. It's not like I didn't enter it lightly. Like it was like, you know, I mean, it's a, serious, potentially, you know, there's like all kinds of potential health complications. We don't even know what these hormones do to us. So like, it's a big deal, but I guess I just don't see it as something that, as a person who's lived a lot of different kinds of experiences, it just doesn't seem radically different to me than anything else.
And that discomfort, it builds in you.
Yeah. It's literally like being in a relationship that's not working.
Yeah. And then you're just like, okay, something's got to change.
Yeah. I mean, when you reach a point where you're like, we have got to end this, or someone reaches that point or whatever, it like, you know, you feel in your body like this is not working for me. And it's like every day, I think a relationship is a good example, but imagine the relationship was with the whole world, you know, like, and you're like engaging with the world and you're like, this just feels bad and it's feeling worse. And I'm sort of pretending like it's not feeling as bad as it's feeling, because I don't want to let it go. I don't want to change. I don't want to have to deal with what everything that will happen if we end this relationship. Me and the world. But then just at some point, if you need to do the right thing, is to end it. And people, I think no one sits around going like, but that's so mysterious. Why do people end their relationships? Like, why would you ever want to move from one relationship to the next? It's like, to me, it's not any different than that. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, it's a feeling that it if you haven't experienced it in the sense of gender, maybe that's true. But I think I don't totally believe that people haven't experienced a genuine sense of dissonance, everyone, with gender identity on some level, especially men, because I think a lot of what being a masculine person is dehumanizing. Yeah. And I think most men who are ethical and moral and integrous people have experiences where they're like, this feels bad, you know? And it doesn't mean they're not men. It means this role, you know, isn't working. But anyway, that's not the same, I guess, but there's something about feeling, just something's alarmingly off. Like, I think we've all felt that. And that's, to me, what my experience was, you know?
And the, again, it's like me looking for binary kind of markers, but the process of transitioning, does it have an end point?
I don't know. I guess it's sort of like everybody's different. Yeah. I think for me, it had a start point, sort of, though I guess you could also say it's got a start point that starts when I was
born. When you were born.
Like,
I had a feeling you'd say that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it doesn't really have a start point. I think medical intervention is useful, and it helps that we live in a time where there's technology that lets trans people who want to have hormones, like, have them. Plenty of trans people don't. But I guess for me, I do a lot of like writing about this stuff because it's interesting, and I'm a writer, and so it's an interesting way to look at the world. And I thought I would get tired of looking at it this way, but it's actually only, and it seems like everyone's interested in gender now, so that's cool. I mean, it's problematic for the reasons we're talking about it, but it's always been problematic for those reasons. So there's obviously a period in which hormones stop affecting you. You know, you've sort of gone as far as you can go in terms of the physical changes, but I don't think that's what you're asking. Or,
well, I guess, did you notice the way the world, with a capital W, interacted with you pre versus post hormones?
Yeah, I'm writing a book about it.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's called Amateur. You should buy it. It's coming out in August.
We'll put it in the show notes.
It's from Scribner. But I really wanted that book. I started it I started it 4 years into my transition. And a lot of why I was writing it was because, similarly to my transition, starting my transition, the book starts in 2015 when I was having this summer where guys kept trying to fight me. And it was sort of like, 4 years into my transition, you know, I'd moved, I started my job here. I was like, you know, pretty sort of steadily in my life. Yes. And then this was happening. Like, people, these guys were starting all summer. Guys tried to fight me, like street fight me. Like, I don't know. It hasn't happened since. Yeah, it was weird. But I feel like for me, it was a tipping point because it was almost like the last in a line of things where it's not like I'd been like keeping my head down exactly, but I think I was just hoping that things would just resolve themselves, things that I was uncomfortable with about masculinity, I could kind of just on my own over time sort of intuitively sort out and it would be fine. And I guess like that was it. I was like, okay, this is fucking weird. Like, sorry, I hope I can say fuck.
No, please say fuck.
Like, why are men trying to fight me? Why would men want to fight, period? That was just so different and outside my realm of my previous socialization that I was like, I need to actively face this. I need to understand male violence, which is something I've been subject to my whole life. I need to understand why it's expected of me. And there were so many things about being a man that I just was uncomfortable about. And I wanted to I felt like I was sort of benefiting from being male in a lot of ways, but I also was uncomfortable with aspects of being a man, and I just wanted to like look at those things, which is sort of the first rule of being a man, right? Is like that you don't ask any questions. And I just wanted to ask questions. And so I did. So the book is based on what happened next, which is that I wrote a story for Quartz where I decided to like use boxing as a way to explore this. Cause I knew a guy who sat on a board of a charity fight.
White collar boxing.
Yeah. White collar boxing thing. Where at the end you fight at Madison Square Garden. And I thought like, okay, well, if I want to learn about violence, maybe I can like do it through this like sort of hallowed American experience of boxing, which has also got a lot of obviously interesting racial and class and historical undertones. And also I was just interested in why men would risk their bodies when they don't have to. These men who were really rich who were doing this thing in the first place. So I pitched it to Quartz as a story. I wrote the story for Quartz. I did fight at Madison Square Garden. And then I wrote a book that I've been working on ever since that'll be done soon, which sort of it elaborates on a lot of the questions I was asking. So like, am I a real man? And sort of then becomes a reported journey of like, what does it mean to be a real man? Where does that phrase even come from? Like what is the purpose of the phrase? Or like, am I sexist? In what ways am I sexist? Like, how have I internalized like ideas about women and men, you know, and all these things. So like, I just wrote a book kind of to interrogate and answer my own discomfort about this sort of new role in my life that, you know, I think it's a unique thing about masculinity that men, in order to sort of uphold it, are supposed to just quietly disappear into the night of it. And trans men especially, right? Because we can be sort of questioned. But I guess I figured if I questioned it first, it kind of makes me invulnerable to that questioning, you know? So that's what the book's about. And that's my answer to the question of like transitioning. I guess it just doesn't ever feel like it's over. I didn't want it to feel over because I felt like I could see things differently. And I didn't want to forget that I'm seeing things differently. Yeah. I think the things that were making me uncomfortable, I really felt like were worth saying. It feels like people are talking about those things now a lot.
What is it or what was it about being a man that made you uncomfortable? Or the virtues of manliness that made you...
Well, I think it was... I mean, now I know a lot about what was making me uncomfortable because I've done all this research and talked... But it was just a lot of the mythologies around what sociologists call toxic masculinity, which is, like, not inherent to masculinity. Masculinity isn't even inherent at all. It's just it's a gender role. But the way we socialize boys, especially even as young as infants, you know, like they've done studies where like mothers talk to girls more than they talk to boys, like even in infancy, or, you know, like the way we socialize boys to basically like as soon as possible, as soon as sort of like adolescence, to like disconnect emotionally from friends, and this idea of manning up and, you know, all of that. Like, I think the effects of that exist in men and also in what we expect of men. So I went from living in the world where, you know, I was a pretty androgynous person. I think a lot of gender roles just didn't apply to me. Nobody was really trying to enforce them. Yeah. And I didn't know that. That was just my life.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize that I wasn't subject to those things kind of from anyone. I mean, I guess more I was experiencing female socialization, but even so, because I was masculine looking and tomboyish, I think I got to escape a lot of the things women are expected to do. And then I was in a suddenly extremely, I mean, I have a beard, I've got tattoos, I look a certain way, and I was experiencing the world in this very hyper-masculine way, and I had no frame of reference for it at all. And I was in my 30s. So I thought, not like, you know, I mean, obviously initially, like all humans, because we're animals, I was like, I guess I should try to fit in. But I just felt like offended by what was expected of me. Not by being, I love being a man, obviously. I went through a lot to be one. But sort of socially, what that meant in a lot of situations felt bad. Like, people didn't touch me anymore. My mom died in that period. And I felt like my grief, like, it was expected that I not talk about it, or like not be too upset, or sort of handle it in a specific way. It was, sociologists call it the man box, but it's like this sort of constricted sense of self that a lot of men have, and it's a social condition, you know?
Do you think earlier in your life you would have grieved differently?
Yeah, I mean, I did grieve differently, but I just felt very aware of the kind of, I mean, the number one problematic thing about masculinity is policing of gender. You know, that's the idea of the real man. There's really, it's rare that I've heard anyone call anyone else a real woman. It's like it's not really a thing. So I think that idea even is really poisonous, right?
Yeah, like, why? I never thought about that.
Yeah. Like the sociologist Michael Kimmel, who's like the main masculinity studies guy, he says, there's not one masculinity, there's masculinities. He said, if there's any one myth about men, you know, or about masculinity that he would want to change first, it would be that. That there's like one defined idea about what being a man is. It's really odd when you think about it, because we're just human beings. So, of course, we all have different ways of being in the world. And that conformity tends to not be good. It's not like we're conforming around like
positive virtues.
Yeah. You know, we're really not.
Yeah,
we're conforming around
like procreation, violence,
yeah, right,
ego.
Right. Things that are really harmful and literally harmful. Men are more likely to not be environmentally friendly because it's like, this is like one of the fragile masculinity things, but because they perceive it as feminine. Anything men perceive as feminine, they're not as likely to do. So they're less likely to recycle, for example. I mean, that's literally dangerous to the earth.
Yeah.
Wow. That's weird. You know?
That is, God, I never thought about that. And the policing comes from the peer group, basically?
It comes from everyone. Yeah. I mean, that was part of what was so strange. Like, for me anyway, it's like random strangers have like said things to me about my body and space, or have used their bodies to let me know, you know, like, I mean, haven't we all experienced that? If you're the smallest guy in a situation and a bigger guy like wants to throw his weight around, he just does. And then you learn something from that. Like, okay, being small isn't good. Like, I need to, you know, be able to be, to face up. And so people think, oh, that's evolutionary, that's biological, you know, but from everything, I mean, one big myth that I was able to, and I was afraid to honestly really explore this because I was scared of what the answer was, but one big myth that I explore in my book is, does testosterone lead to aggression? Like, is there a correlation between those things? And I talked to this like really well-regarded neurobiologist out of Stanford. Is he a neurobiologist? He might be a neuroscientist. But anyway, a biologist or neuroscientist out of Stanford who said that there's not an aggression receptor in the brain. That's not actually a thing. Testosterone makes us status-seeking, but not necessarily aggressive. It's just that in most human engagements, 99% of them, to have status, you requires aggression. But that's because we require it, not because it's true. And he talked about this economic game, like this study where the men did this economic game where like you were rewarded if you were collaborative and cooperative. And the guys who had the highest measured testosterone did the best in the game, were the most collaborative and the most cooperative. But interestingly, the guys who thought that they'd been given a testosterone shot, they hadn't been, they were the biggest dicks. Oh, wow. So our sense of that is just so powerful, like socially, you know, like we think that men are a certain way, so then we are, you know, and that, I guess that to me was like, it's what I was feeling was true, but the whole book is about being like, is this all true or what?
Yeah.
And it was kind of a house of cards. I was like, it is all true.
Yeah.
Like, this is all kind of bullshit. Like, what are we doing?
And so you started this before all the Me Too stuff.
Yeah, this was like in 2015. But just as a trans person, I was like, you know, I like being a man. Again, happy to be a man, like super stoked on it, like makes me happy every single day.
Yeah.
But a lot of what seems to be what people expect me to do, or what situations I found myself in that just have felt like, again, like an insult to my integrity.
Yeah.
I just don't think that they're inherent to being male. I don't think giving myself testosterone means I have to be an asshole.
Yeah. Like, in the book or just in your travels, did you see a way to work through this, or how we either as individuals or as a society work through this? And I'll start by saying that, like, my whole life, I bought the emotional disconnection myth that, like, the more disconnected I am, the more of a man I'll be, the better I'll be able to perform and all these things. And it all came crashing down on me. And it's like, fuck, this is not how I want to live my life. And in fact, the more in touch I got with that connection, the more I was able to thrive. So it's almost like, not only is the myth wrong, but it's wrong in the wrong direction too. It's
definitely
like doubly wrong.
Yeah,
you know?
And it's a lot of where culturally things are falling apart right now, because
yeah,
we've really gone all the way in that direction. You know, this psychologist I talked to for my book, and I've talked to for a bunch of stories for courts, who I really like, named Niobe Way. She's a developmental psychologist, and she's worked for decades. She's out of NYU. She's worked with boys for decades, adolescent boys, like done studies on sort of them and how they, especially like male friendship, like, because she says that there's a point where boys, and she has these amazing testimonials of boys talking about their best friends up until they're like 16 in these incredibly flowery, like, you know, in the same way girls talk about their best friends, like just saying they love them, like talking about them. It's just like incredible, intimate way. And then there's this point where that changes, where that becomes like, you know, the opposite of okay, because like, as she would say, anything girly or gay, you know, and that's quotes from the boys, is not masculine. And she says, like, you know, that, to her, that disruption of intimacy is like where a lot of problems start, you know. And like later we see like a lot of violence that happens from men, like it happens in the domestic sphere. Like there's just, it's like hard to imagine that boys and men who are disconnecting from themselves emotionally aren't like sort of ticking time bombs, yeah. You know, on some level, like, yeah. Because we all need intimacy. It's like a human need. But she says, you know, exactly that like to be a man is to literally not be human. I mean, that's like kind of the definition of, yeah. In that way, toxic masculinity. And that's how we socialize boys. So it's hard to be then surprised when we see men behave in ways that are inhumane, you know? I mean, it's hard to look at the extremes of that and not to say those people aren't accountable for their behavior, because plenty of men look around and go, this is bad, like I want to change this, but we all have a little bit of a say in this, and how we are to each other and how we treat ourselves and how we, you know, raise our sons. And you know, if we don't look at it, like, so I think the step one is like Carl Jung had a theory of the shadow, but like this idea that the rejected parts of you are become this shadow that you like drag around behind you, and then you like project onto others. And the only way to like really be, and this was his explanation of evil, and it came out of like him looking at the Nazis and being like, how can anyone do this? And the sympathizers, like, how did anyone be a sympathizer to this? And that was his theory, is that like, well, they rejected in themselves the things that like they could kind of relate to about the people who were being oppressed, and so that then they end up like, you know, projecting that rejection onto everything. I think if you can look at the shadow and the things that are rejected through your masculinity and reincorporate it, like, so for men that's femininity, and like, and I don't know, all the shame that like you know, like facing down, like that's what keeps men in line, is a shame, you know. And shame is what leads to violence almost always. So that's a prison psychologist, James Gilligan, who says that.
And the shame coming from not playing the role of a man, or from failure?
Failure.
From,
I mean, that. So James Gilligan is a prison psychologist. He studied like violent criminals for a really long time. And that was his theory. He wrote a book called On Violence. It's amazing. And he said that like every criminal, like every offender, even the ones who've done the most horrific stuff, if you dug down deep enough, like that was their motivating factor, was they felt enormous shame. And that to me, like, I mean, that's to me a feature of masculinity, is like an enormous sense of shame for when you're not being a real man and you're not doing this like the way you're supposed to and you're failing. And but just questioning that for a minute is like, I think, a pretty revolutionary act, because it's like, well, why do I need to perform this way? What if it wasn't actually important? Or what if it doesn't make me real? I think that's where things change. Honestly, for me, like going through that process, because this was your original question, was like, well, what can we do to change it? I think going through the process of really questioning my own darkest, deepest, like weirdest ideas about masculinity was so helpful, because where I landed was like, you know what? I stand with women with all this stuff. I just do. Like when Me Too happened, I was like, yep, definitely. First of all, Me Too. But second of all, like, you know, like, I mean, it's not even a question to me. Like, of course all of this stuff is happening. And of course the first thing I should do is say, I hear you, I see you at work, at, you know, at home, wherever I'm hearing people talk about this, you know? And I think to me, I guess what's so startling is how I think that actually a lot of men maybe weren't doing that right away, because you're supposed to reject anything feminine, even people who are like you need to empathize with in that moment. You know, it's almost like you have to train yourself to get out of the, if I identify with a woman, therefore that makes me not man enough. That's really weird. Just when you start like breaking it down, you know? So I guess that's the thing, is like, just, I think everybody needs to have their own journey with that. But I think if men saw the ways that it's inhibiting to them, like really, like to your ability to be a person, yeah. Like to your point, you know, when you're driving in that direction and it's just making you feel less and less human.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not like a life well lived, you know?
And that's where what touches with this podcast and my writing, where my Twitter tagline is finding joy in uncomfortable introspection. So it's those parts of ourselves that we reject and deny, that we're ashamed of, And once you get in touch with them, you know, the Jung quote that I like is, until we make the subconscious conscious, it will dictate our lives and we'll call it fate.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, holy shit.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, don't you have a story from when you were a boy when you first learned like what it was that you were supposed to be doing?
Oh my God, yeah.
Well, what is it? Yeah, what's the first time?
I think one of my first encounters on sexuality was that when I walk, and I still walk, like I kind of like sashay my hips a bit. And so like from that, we're like growing up, like queer name calling, like verbal bullying. And I have large lips. So like that becomes an asset later in life. But like when you're a teenager, it's like DSLs, Angelina Jolie, like, and so like right away. So like I spent my whole teenage, even like now to this point, learning to like tuck my lips in and like thinking about how I took every single step. So it's like fuck, like I've never actually verbalized that ever.
Yeah.
To any, not even to my wife.
Yeah.
And to know that like you're carrying that just to like be like, just to not be called gay.
Yeah.
You
right.
know?
Like as if there's something wrong with being gay.
Exactly.
Right?
And yeah, even in 1994.
Right.
Like,
well, because it's not even about being gay, right? Yeah. No, it's just
it's
about
other, it's otherness. It's
and not being a real man
yeah.
and falling in line.
Yep.
In this sort of warrior culture way that's
yeah.
like, I mean, what to what end? Like,
yeah.
you know, and the boys who are doing that to you, I'm sure it's not like they had like some conscious agenda to like
yeah.
further patriarchy, but they were doing just that because
yeah.
it's like, that's the point, like
yeah.
to uphold this, it's practice so that then when you go on to, you know, whatever environment, like you'll be so freaked by like slipping and seeming
yeah.
any of these things that you won't defend the women or the gay people or anyone who's different because you need to just uphold your own,
yeah.
you know, gender. And that makes you, you know, fragile. And that's the whole idea of fragile masculinity. It's like fucked up. Like,
yeah.
who cares if you walk in a certain way?
Yeah. And I saw that in, I mean, you see, it's particularly visceral on Wall Street.
Yeah, I've heard.
Where, you know, you stay in line, right? Because the gigantic, air quotes, stakes are high, you know, like so much is on the line. And I mean, talk about a conformist, ego-driven culture driven by a fear of wanting to connect with yourself emotionally. I mean, that right there you have the ingredients for just like a life not well lived and the real like toxic like fallout across dimensions that we have yet to even see.
Yeah. And that to me is masculinity.
Yeah.
Like it's, and there's not a big disconnect between, you know, I mean, I've been reading a lot of like history and like especially like black historians who've traced like how white, like whiteness, which is also an invention just like gender, came to be, and like, you know, like how over time like this sort of ideal of especially white masculinity has come to like sort of stand for, which is capital, like a certain kind of capitalism, all of it is like mixed into one thing.
Yeah.
Very much embodied by guys on Wall Street. And it's like extremely unhealthy for all of us. And
yeah.
we know that. Like, we've already seen it go horribly wrong once, but yet here we are again, like in the same situation.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing to give up. And I think men especially have a lot of scarcity about power.
That's the theme of this podcast, all that is scarcity.
Yeah.
Scarcity mindsets drive me first, fuck everyone else.
But that's a gen, I mean, women can have it, but it's a gendered.
Oh yeah, definitely agree.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like something that boys are taught specifically,
yeah.
you know, like that you've got it from a young age. You
yeah.
have to, and I have a lot of compassion for men for this reason, because
yeah.
I think, you know, I think once you know it and you don't do anything about it, that's, you know, it's kind of on you. But at some point, like, there needs to be a first point of really, and after a certain age, a little bit, you do know it. But like, once someone said to you, look, like, this is like, we're living in a structure where you've been trained from a young age to behave a certain way, and it's hurting people, including yourself.
Yeah.
Like, why are you doing this? Stop. Like, or look at yourself or ask yourself why. And people who don't want to do that at that point, then it's sort of just on them, you know, which we're seeing more and more of. It was interesting working with the guys I was boxing with, who are all finance guys.
Yeah, what did you see about finance masculinity?
I guess it was interesting because I really didn't understand why you would risk your body if you were wealthy, which all these guys were. Like, I mean, that's sort of the thing. But I learned through actually Nell Irvin Painter, who's a black historian who wrote The History of White People, that there's always been sort of baked into masculinity and white masculinity in particular, this idea of looking towards the sort of real men who tend to be sort of the underclasses and sort of seeing them as like more like virile and like more masculine. And like when you think about boxing in general, like the guys in tuxedos looking at the guys fighting, like that's always, it's always been classed in that way. So I think that this sort of fantasy of being able to be in the ring yourself is sort of the like completion of like a probably a millennia old like, you know, thing. And a lot of the guys I worked with like told me, you know, hey, we would be doing coke with our clients like 20 years ago, but now this is the thing, like we, you know, we fight them like in the ring or whatever. So on one hand it was like affirming a lot of stereotypes, I think. But also, you know, I mean, I loved the guys. I didn't know anybody from finance before, really. So I loved the guys I trained with. Yeah. And I found boxing to be an incredibly nuanced bonding experience that was nothing like what I expected it to be. It was really beautiful, actually. And because men were liberated of the need to prove their masculinity, it became a space that was actually one of the most emotionally generative spaces I've ever shared with men. And I felt like I was on a team, you know, it's not a team sport, but just co-training with people who I saw every day for hours and who were really encouraging and supportive. And, you know, I didn't tell anyone I was trans throughout the experience because I just wanted to really see what it would be like if that wasn't sort of an upfront mediating thing about me. But later, you know, when the story came out, and then as I've been writing the book, I've been in touch with a lot of the people, the coaches and the people I train with. And it was really interesting how little of an issue that was. I wasn't sure how that would come, you know, but I think like anything, when it's like, you get to know somebody,
It all kind of melts away.
Yeah. So, I mean, I tend to be a real humanist and I have like a genuine like sense of optimism about people because of that, because every time I'm really in connection with anyone, they always turn up and have, you know, I've yet to be completely disappointed by a human being who I really, as an adult, have like put my value in that way, you know, in a professional context or in a context around gender. So I think people try, you know. So I didn't have a negative experience with boxing or with finance guys or whatever, but I did see all of those markers of extreme masculinity in those guys more than I have other men, for sure.
How do you talk with such optimism? And if you look at the state of the world, whether it's like specifically the trans community and this administration, whether it's the, you know, this toxic masculinity literally gone awry, how do you maintain that sense of optimism in light of some pretty negative shit every day?
Yeah, well, I mean, I felt worse when people weren't talking about it.
It's almost like until you make the subconscious conscious, right?
That's how I feel. I don't think it's bad. I think all of the things that are going on right now are the natural byproducts of something that's been happening forever. So I think I don't like the moment we're in any more than most people, I think, but than most people I know. And I'm definitely scared and I'm, you know, concerned and all of those things. But I also think it's a huge opportunity. And I'm heartened by not always the way the conversations are happening. I don't think every conversation that's happening is productive. I don't think we have the way we're using social media to talk to each other is super useful. But I guess I just feel like when I've believed the best about people, they've been their best selves. And part of that is conversation. Like you were saying earlier, it's like you were like, I'm going to be uncomfortable and I'm probably going to say the wrong things. And like, you know, if I was some random person on Twitter and you were like tweeting at me and saying the wrong things, like maybe we would have just an argument and then that would be the end of the conversation and it wouldn't be productive at all. And you'd probably be affirmed in whatever, you know, not that you would be saying negative things to me, but you know what I'm saying. So I guess to me, it's like more useful to just assume that people can rise to their best selves. And I guess I've had so much experience where that's what seems to be what motivates people. My concern isn't so much that people don't have it in them. It's like, how do you get people to have a sustained interest in doing that? Because I think a lot of people are concerned not with their own growth. I still think that's not human nature. I think that's human culture. So I think most people really fundamentally are happiest when they have a sense of like well-being and integrity and all of those things are aligned with being good to other people. I believe that. So I don't know. It just seems true.
I'm with you. And I mean, maybe if we just take this as a droplet, right? Like this conversation is going to go out to thousands of, you know, finance and professional, a lot of men who have never been privy to this type of conversation and are willing and open to partake in
it. And you know what? If you got this far, you're probably really uncomfortable and you're probably confused and have weird questions and like you should Google them and they're all available online. But like, you know, but maybe ask like why it's so important to understand these things like surgeries or like whatever. Like what is the reason why that's the thing that you're wondering about versus like how am I part of this like idea of masculinity, or what about my masculinity makes me uncomfortable? Because that I hope would be the question that would be more meaningful at this point. But maybe if it's not, like, why not? Like, why not ask, you know, because it's uncomfortable. But being uncomfortable is the point of the podcast.
Well, Thomas, this has been awesome. And again, I really admit it. When I entered the conversation, there was a certain way that I kind of was projecting it, and it was nothing like that way. But again, it just shows the conditioning that one has around things that are different.
Yeah, exactly.
And how much the cultural narrative really shapes your even like initial perception of a topic, which I think we can all learn from that.
Yeah, because we should think about how that's true for race and gender and class and just about ourselves. How does the idea of being a man shape your body and how you are in space and the way you think about women, how does that, you know, how did you come to those thoughts? Like, and the way you think about people of color or white people or like all of it, like how is it all coming, you know, like we're getting that from not ourselves. And I think when we sit down and talk to each other, it's a really different conversation always, you know.
Where can our listeners go to learn more about you and buy your book?
They can go to my website, thomaspagemcbee.com. If you Google me, you should find my book. It's on Amazon. Man Alive is out, and Amateur will be out in August.
Awesome. We'll put all those in the show notes.
Awesome.
Thank you so much, Thomas.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Rad Awakenings podcast. For more information on all things rad, including our weekly email newsletter, please visit us at radreads.co. This podcast is a labor of love and funded by the community's generosity. And if you're interested in supporting us, please join us as a patron by visiting patreon.com/radreads. And of course, leaving a 5-star review always goes a long way. Thanks again, and until next time.